Hello, dear listener, and welcome to Radio SGN. I'm one of the hosts, Lindsay Anderson.
And I'm Benny Loy.
My pronouns are she, her.
And I'm she, they.
And this is the show where we basically just talk about gay news. We interview a super cool person in the local Seattle queer community. We have fun. And I think one of the first fun things that I wanted to bring up really quick is something that has come to my attention on TikTok. It's this trend called the fuck-ass bob. Have you heard of this, Benny?
I have not. Is it like a, what is it, a wolf cut?
No, it's like, okay, so to have a fuck-ass bob, it has to be like universal, like straight across. I'm like motioning with my hands for you to see, but listeners, you can't see. Like a bob that would, you know, end around from the shoulder to the chin, you know, that range. There's been some debate about whether or not a fuck-ass bob can or cannot have bangs. One TikTok creator said that you can't have bangs to have a fuck-ass bob. So like Taylor Swift's bob era was not a fuck-ass bob. But others have said you can. The trend comes from Euphoria because there was a scene in Euphoria where Kat, who's like a character who has a bob, the principal is basically getting her in trouble because this video went viral of her like doing some sexy things and she's like underage, she's in high school and they're like, yo, is this you? And she's like, are you pointing this out because you recognize me because I'm overweight and I'm the only overweight person in Euphoria? And also she's like not overweight, but anyways. And then the principal's like, no, it's because you have that fuck-ass bob. And it just went viral because everybody's like, she does have a fuck-ass bob. So now the trend is people saying like behind every girl with long hair is a little girl with a fuck-ass bob. And I was a little girl with a fuck-ass bob. I had a fuck-ass bob from the time I was like 2 until middle school when I like started intentionally growing my hair out. It's really got me thinking about like childhood haircuts and how they shape your identity a little bit. Because, you know, you don't like have control over how your hair looks when you're really little. And I did not want to have a fuck-ass bob, but I did. And I want to know, did you have a fuck-ass bob? Did you ever have that phase?
I think so. Back when I was a kid, come from a traditional household, so girls are supposed to have long hair. And back then, I didn't know what the real difference was between boys and girls. And me being non-binary, I was like, I don't necessarily want to be either of these, but I think I'd prefer if I was treated like a boy, because then at least I get to do all this cool extra stuff without any like worry. Like I can climb a tree without any any pushback. And so I was like, well, clearly the only difference between boys and girls is hair length. And so as a little child, like 3 or 4 years old, I was being babysat by my uncle. While he wasn't paying attention, I stole some kitchen scissors. I went into the bathroom and I just started just chopping it off. Not even looking in a mirror because I wasn't tall enough. I was just hanging all of my head over a wastebasket and then just straight into the wastebasket. And so for a while, I had pretty short hair because I chopped it all off. I was crying when my mom got home because my uncle found me in the bathroom chopping all of my hair off. And then he freaked out because he thought my mom was going to kill him.
Yeah, your poor uncle. Like, I don't even know what I would do in that situation if I was like babysitting some little kid and they cut all their hair off. I'd be like, oh my God, we're going to go get you extensions, stat.
But yeah, so I like, for a little while as a little toddler, I rocked a very similar haircut to what I have now, which is fairly short hair. And then it grew out and then my family tried to have it long and tried to curl it. And then I finally got the courage to cut it off. But yeah, I definitely had some fuck-ass bobs.
Yeah. I feel like hairstyle, it's something we maybe don't talk about enough as a society or whatever. But it's so like indicative of your gender identity, but like your sense of self, you know? And there really is something about like when you can first kind of explore yourself through your hair. And it's like, because it's a commitment too. You know, if you cut all your hair off like that and you don't like it, you're like stuck like that for months. So like I said, I had a fuck-ass bob forever. And when I was like a little kid, it was fine. Like my mom wanted to keep it short because I didn't comb my hair. It was just always messy and she called it a rat's nest all the time. It would get matted. I would have like mats on the back of my head. But then when I was like, got to be a little bit older, you know, self-conscious, all of my friends had like really long, beautiful hair and they would braid it and do like all these cool things with their hair. And it's also like, as kind of a tomboy kid, you know, I feel like there's different ways that you can express like masculinity with your hair. Like, of course, there is like cutting it off and having really short hair. But then there's also like the sporty like ponytails and, you know, braids, like the Laura Ingalls look. And
or the classic baseball cap.
Yes. Oh, my God. I was such a baseball cap kid.
Me too. And beanies. Just any kind of hat. I like wore them constantly.
I still do. So excited for beanie season that's coming up.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I remember the like finally being able to like try different hairstyles with my hair. Because I felt too girly having hair that was too short to put up in a ponytail when I would like play soccer and have my hair down. So then when I grew it out just so I could wear a ponytail every single day and be like, I'm not a girly girl. I have a ponytail. So yeah, that's my hair journey. I've had bangs since I was two. Never grown them out.
I don't think I've ever had bangs.
Really? You have kind of a side bang going
like,
on.
Kind of. I mean, with my shorter hair. But I've never had, like, full-on, like, covering up my forehead.
It's because you have a good forehead.
Thank you.
Like, hold your hand up again. You have, like, an actual, like, yeah, like a forehead, you know? I feel like I have, like, a five head or something. The bang, it's just such a commitment. And I've said this before, but, like, having bangs, it feels like, to me, because my forehead's been covered my whole life, that when I do pull them back, like in a hat or something on like, you know, a day where they're just not cooperating, I feel like the same feeling in my core that I do if I were to like go outside without a bra on, you know, just like a part of me that is natural and should be embraced is exposed and people are staring at it. And so that's why I have bangs.
Oh,
someday I'll grow them out.
I could tell you right now, you don't have to worry. Your forehead's not a billboard. It's okay.
Thank you. You say that now, but you've never seen me without bangs, baby.
That is true. You could lift that up and I could see a That's whole just, Geico ad.
Ooh. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. But yeah, I'm really glad that I don't have a five head because, I mean, I feel like some deity felt that it was unfortunate enough for me to have all my teeth scrunched up and then really bad eyesight. They were just like, We can't do this to this kid. We can't give him a billboard forehead.
Sorry, this is like a sharp conversation turner. But speaking of ugly childhood hairs and fuck-ass bobs and chopping all your hair off as a kid, which is definitely like a queer experience you must experience at some point. Uggo, Ron DeSantis, was booed at a vigil this week. So this is some news you missed in the SGN. Nobody's written about it yet. Maybe check out next week. There was over the weekend a tragic shooting that happened in Jacksonville, Florida at the Jacksonville Dollar General store where a racist gunman killed three black people. Police have already confirmed like this was a hate crime. The gunman was overtly racist. He had a racist manifesto, all of this stuff. Anyways, Ron DeSantis showed up to the vigil to speak as the acting governor of Florida, and the people at the vigil booed him. They did not want him there. They were really adamant about something that I think we talk a lot about on this podcast, that politicians are not innocent in the words that they speak. And Ron DeSantis has been very active in his racism when it comes to taking away critical race studies, literally getting rid of textbooks and trying to say that slavery wasn't a bad thing. And it's that kind of rhetoric that leads to these kinds of violent crimes that we're seeing an uptick in. Yeah, right before we got on this podcast, we both kind of watched the video of Ron DeSantis getting booed. What were your thoughts on that video, Benny?
So there is a little bit a feeling of being torn because it's a vigil, right? And you kind of want to set aside things for such an occasion. You know, you want to be able to be peaceful and just focus on memorializing the people that were victimized by this. But at the same time, at one point, somebody took the mic and said, basically, let's not make this about parties. But that's really hard. That's really hard when you have someone like Ron DeSantis, who, like you said, has done a lot to worsen things in our country, not only with gay people, but also, like you said, racist rhetoric. And if it was just a governor without a history like this, attending, you know, a vigil in their state, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. But when it's specifically this person with what they've done, it's kind of hard to to set politics and parties aside.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And just kind of checking one of these articles, this one's from NBC News, where they mentioned that Ron DeSantis, in his speech there, he called the shooter a scumbag. And someone responded, respectfully, Governor, he was not a scumbag. He was a racist. And I think that that really speaks to Ron DeSantis's ignorance isn't even the word, because I don't think he's ignorant. I think he is racist. But him trying to tiptoe around this, you know, it's always these like white racist politicians that try to make it like as if these crimes aren't about race, or, you know, the hate crimes that we've talked about earlier on this podcast that had to do with sexuality, trying to argue that, oh, well, these are just scumbags. These people, these criminals are, you know, that there's something wrong with them, that it's a mental health issue, when in reality,
they always, always do this. Instead of speaking plainly and telling it as it is, which, you know, would be nice to be able to recognize what's actually causing these problems, they'll create scapegoats like this, where it's like, oh, it's out of our hands, basically.
Yeah.
What they say.
It's like, it is so in your hands. Your hands molded the clay that this man wrote his manifesto on and then used to buy a gun. Like, it is just, Florida is fucking Florida. The NAACP issued a travel advisory for, like, telling Black people not to go to the state. We saw there's been advisories for LGBTQ people in the state of Florida as well.
A ton of people are leaving the state because of these conditions, including not just, you know, LGBT folks, but also people from immigrant families or even immigrants themselves. And it's scary that they have to flee their own state to feel safe. It doesn't have to be like this, but, you know, a lot of it is because one guy is
the worst.
The worst.
Yeah. It's also, gosh, I mean, thinking about people fleeing, like, I saw TikTok last week about a family where the dad was talking about how much it's changed his family's life to move to Seattle from Florida, that they have a transgender child and their child feels affirmed and safe here. It's like, that is so good for these people. But at the same time, it is also such a financial privilege to be able to get out and leave. You know, the people that were killed at a dollar store. You know, like, these are not the people that have the means to get out of Florida. You know, the luxury of, like I've been saying, if Trump or DeSantis, whoever the Republican nominee is, wins the next election, I'm out of this country. That's a privilege to say that, you know, our hearts are with the people of Florida right now, the people that are mourning, and also the people that were brave enough to say fuck you to Ron DeSantis for showing up there and acting like he did not encourage this man to kill three Black people.
In most cases, doing that at a vigil would be in poor taste. In this case, I think it's absolutely valid. He shouldn't have been there with the kind of rhetoric he pulls. So
that was a little bit of a taste of politics. We will have some more politics later in the show, so please stick around for that.
Here at the SGN, we're all about the sudden ups and downs.
Yes. This podcast is like all the fun of being on a roller coaster with your friends that talk a little bit too much.
Yeah, it's like riding a roller coaster while trying to talk your friend through an existential crisis.
Life is like an SGN podcast. There are sudden shifts and twists and turns. And because of capitalism, we sometimes have to go to commercial breaks, which we're going to do right now. And then we will be right back with a super fun interview. Hello, and thank you for joining us again. With me today is actress of the film and stage, Patricia Quinn. She is zooming in all the way from London. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And how are you doing this afternoon for you? It's morning for me, Patricia.
Oh, I'm fine. Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks. Very good to hear. So it's a special anniversary this year. They are celebrating in London the 50th anniversary of the stage play Rocky Horror Picture, which Patricia Quinn was in.
The stage play is called The Rocky Horror Show. There's no picture in it. People do get confused. The point is, the stage show is called The Rocky Horror Show. And then we did the stage show in 1973 in London. That's when it began, in a 60-seat theatre at the Royal Court Theatre in Sloane Square. And it was actually a room with a few chairs in it, 60 chairs. no stage, no, you know, no room to do anything, actually. Small. And that's where it began. Then 2 years later, we made the film in 1975, which was a great shock to all of us. We never imagined we'd ever make a film of it. So the whole thing's been an amazing surprise. Anyway, there are the dates for it. So in London at the moment, the actual stage show is on tour. And in fact, the stage show is around the world on tour. It never stops, that stage show. And it's been in London about a month ago. And I went to see it and it was joyous. And we were there for the 50th anniversary. It was wonderful on the stage at the Peacock Theatre in London.
That sounds so cool. What was it like watching 50 years later a play that you started?
Well, it's extraordinary. Of course, I've been watching it forever because I do Comic Cons. I've been involved in this for 50 years. I mean, it's been an extraordinary journey. This Rocky Horror has taken me around the world, promoting it for 20th Century Fox. It goes on and on and on. So it became such a part of my life. And it seems to be getting even more so. It's unbelievable. Anyway, it was wonderful to go and see the actual show on stage. Of course, I've seen a million shadow casts across the States and here. And I went back to the actual stage show 21 years later in London. It was on in the West End. So I thought, oh, I've got to do that. So I went back as Magenta 21 years later in London. Going to the Peacock Theatre the other night, they actually invited me to be a narrator on stage, to come on as the narrator. And I said, I don't want to do that, thanks. I want to see the show. I really want to enjoy seeing this show 50 years later on the stage. And they said, but I said, no, because if I'm acting in it, I'll be backstage all night. I won't see it. And I want the pleasure of seeing it. So little Nell was here at the time. She was on stage doing the narrator. The guy who first played Rocky on stage, Rainer Burton, he was on stage doing the narrator. And Ryan Cox, the scientist, he's married to my friend Gia, an American girl who's a great Rocky Horror fan. But so is Brian Cox, the scientist. And little Nell thought it'd be interesting for Mr. Scientist to be a narrator. And I thought, what's he doing on the stage, Brian Cox, the scientist, in our play? Because it's Brian Cox, the actor, Succession. We all know that, I think. But Brian Cox, the scientist I'm talking about. What was astonishing was I arrived at the Peacock Theatre and there were red carpets along the pavement. There was a massive red carpet all on the pavement in the street in London. Railings and ropes. It was so grand, beautiful. And I was about to get out of the taxi and I said to the driver, there were so many Rocky Horror fans, lookalikes, dressed, that I said, oh gosh, we better go a bit further up the street. I thought, I can't get out in the middle of this. Like, it was a massive crowd going in there. And I was the only one not dressed up as me. And so there were, you know, lots of boy magentas, men magentas, and their stilettos. So I kind of prepped in. I'm not sure. They did know who I was, but, you know, anyway, I kind of hid because there were so many, you know, click, click, click. And I thought, oh, it's exhausting. So I went and hid in a corner. And then I went into the show, and the show's brilliant, but it's extraordinary because there are so many choreographed dance numbers in it now. Like, it's a real choreographed show. Well, we never had that, you know. We were just totally simplistic. The only set we had was a wooden chair for Rocky to stand on as the muscle guy, you know, and pose. We only had a wooden chair on the stage. We had no set. And this is, you know, massive set. They sang another song, and I thought, this is another song. You know, everything, it was song after song after song. And I thought, I'm a bit fed up with these songs. But I think it's because they were all so made into dance numbers, every one, you know. For me, it was too much. But what was the best amazing thing was that the whole of the London fan club was there. And I know a lot of those people. And Stephanie Freeman and her husband, David Freeman, are the head of that. And I've known them forever since they began this club. And that's a long, long time. And they were all there and dressed. And what I found extraordinary was the callbacks, you know, the shouting from the audience. It was so perfect in timing and everything. It was actually like, you think it was almost written as part of the show. It was extraordinary. And it was so brilliant, so clever, all the callbacks, you know?
That is so cool.
Yeah, it was wonderful. That was one of the best bits about it for me, because it was so controlled, you know. It was like, you thought it was scripted, the whole thing. It was wonderful. And then a big party afterwards. We had a joyous time.
You mentioned that the stage play has, it's evolved a lot since the first 1973 play. What has it been like for you to watch the different iterations of the play and see how it's kind of changed with time and with popularity?
Well, that's what I've just said, I think. That what I did dislike was it was too choreographed for me. It was too, I prefer a simpler version, that's all.
So I have to ask, going way, way back to 73, what first drew you to the role of Magenta? What was intriguing about that?
Nothing. I read a script. I auditioned. I went for a singing audition for this little musical in a room upstairs at the Royal Court Theatre. And the year before, I'd done his play at the Royal Court Theatre called AC/DC by Heathcote Williams. And that won the Play of the Year award. And I was in that. And then I'd done a few plays at the Royal Court. So the casting director there phoned up and said to my agent, I said, what is it? And he said, I didn't know, some musical they're doing. So I went to the audition, which took place at the Irish Club in Sloane Street. And I am Irish. I'm from Belfast. And I thought, oh, it's funny to go to the Irish Club to audition for this. They said that you needed a rock and roll song. Well, I didn't have a rock and roll song. I had a 1930s song by Jesse Matthews. And I arrived at the audition, and they said, that was Richard O'Brien in his snakeskin jacket, and the director, Jim Sharman, in his wedge white shoes. This is the 70s we're talking about. And I thought, they're a very wicked-looking group. I mean, they weren't like your BBC interview. The guy at the piano, Richard Hartley, the musical director, with his massive, great, fuzzy curls like mine at the time. And they said, so have you got your sheet music? And I said, no, I don't have any music. And they said, oh. And I said, well, I've got it in my head. I knew the tune. And I could see they thought, yeah, right. We've got a right one here. And they were right. So I started to sing, and I sang, I was a prisoner locked in a jail, this 1930s number. You know, love held the only key. And then over my shoulder goes wild cow. 1930s song. And he even looked a bit more bewildered. And Richard O'Brien said, do you think if I play this to you, you could sing this, sing along with me with the guitar? I said, oh, yeah, okay. I thought, oh, gosh. Anyway, so he started to play. Dun, 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 dun. And I thought, oh, what's that? And he played science fiction and started to sing the words, and he had the words, and he showed. Said, could you just try to go along with that? I left that audition. I went out into the King's Road. I ran down the King's Road skipping. I was overjoyed. I thought, that song's brilliant. I thought, gosh, there's something amazing to me about the song. And I knew it. And so I said to my agent, you know, I've heard the song. He said, actually, I just got home, and then before this, I'd said to my agent, what is this about, this thing? He said, I don't know. It's something about a circus, I think, because nobody'd read the script. And he said, something about the circus. And I thought, yeah, it turned out I've been in this circus ever since. I did join the circus. I got home, and within half an hour, the phone rang, and my agent said, they want you to do it. I said, great. And he said, just a minute, which is £18 a week, which doesn't interest an agent or me. Wouldn't pay, you know, for the pussycat. I said, I don't care. I want to do it. And he said, but just collect the script at the stage door of the Royal Court. So I got the script. So the song was for this girl called the Usherette. And there was this other character called Magenta, who had about four lines, which didn't interest me at all. The script was very sparse. There was very little in it. It was only the song that got me. I wasn't interested in magentas or anything. I was only interested in the song. So I said, I'm doing it. So much to my agent's dismay, I did it. That was how it happened. I auditioned.
Thank you for walking me through that process. That sounds like it was very, very exciting. So my next question is, you've had a very successful career even beyond Rocky Horror. How does that make you feel being recognized even today for...
Oh, I love it. It's joyous.
Yeah.
I mean, Little Nell and I did a afternoon chat show on television in the States when we were doing a Comic-Con, Pennsylvania or somewhere. It was a female audience and chat show. And the woman said to Nell and me on the stage, she said, and do you never get tired of these Comic-Cons? And Nell said, well, it's very nice to be worshipped. And the woman said, oh, I could do with a bit of that. And Nell said, get a dog. And I'm glad you laughed because the woman didn't get the irony of that. I nearly fell off my chair because it was so rude, you know, get a dog. And the woman didn't get it at all. And she said, oh, I would love a dog. And I thought, oh, Lord. So that was wasted on her. That was Nell being smart and clever. Anyway, so to be worshipped is gorgeous. It's lovely.
Well, I have to ask too, because some of the biggest fans of yours are in the LGBTQ community. How do you feel about your LGBTQ fans?
The same as every fan. It's all the same to me.
Do you enjoy seeing, like you mentioned earlier, the men that will dress up as your character in high heels? How does that make you feel to see that?
I don't know. You keep asking me how I feel. How about feeling? I'm honored. It's very nice.
Thank you. And again, kind of going back to the early days when you were performing this play on stage, did you have any specific rituals or things that you would do to kind of get into character before beginning?
No, it's called acting, darling. You just turn it on when you do it.
That's amazing to me. I have no experience in acting.
No.
In your career, did you ever face pushback or criticism for your involvement with Rocky Horror?
No.
I'm
the first to leave the show. And I was in it 4 weeks. We had 3 weeks upstairs at the Royal Court. And they actually moved it down the King's Road to a cinema that was up for demolition. Well, that's unheard of for a play to go into a cinema. But this cinema was about to be pulled down. So they took it over for 3 months, I think, the Chelsea Classic. And I mean, by the last week at the theater upstairs, I came up the stairs through the Royal Court Theater itself, going upstairs to the upstairs theater. And Mick Jagger and Bianca in her white suit and cane, she was known to wear that outfit at that time. That was her calling card. Elliot Gould, Bianca, and Jagger were standing, waiting for tickets for Rocky Horror.
Oh, wow.
And I walked past them and with my nose in the air and said, I didn't see them. And went upstairs and I went into our dressing room. It wasn't a dressing room. We didn't have dressing rooms. We only had an office where we all changed together, Tim Curry and Mel and Pat and all the rest. I went in, I said to the audience, I said, Jagger's in! It was great. And then the most amazing thing was when we were there, Coral Brown, the actress, Australian actress, was in the play downstairs at the Royal Court called The Sea. We couldn't go on till The Sea had finished. So we started our play every night at 10 o'clock because of the music and the orchestra band and everything and the noise. So we couldn't start our show till The Sea had finished. Anyway, at the time, Coral Brown was eventually married, but was going out with Vincent Price. And the most amazing thing happened. We finished the show one evening, and the next thing, Vincent Price puts his head round the office door, the dressing room, and told us how wonderful we all were. So wasn't that glorious to have the King of Horror in their dressing room? And Bowie and Jagger and all of them, they were queuing up to get in. Just on hearsay, not even newspapers, material, nothing. Just word of mouth. It was beyond extraordinary what happened. So I was the first to leave that show. I left after 5 weeks and I'd had enough. I'd done it. You know, I'm like that. I mean, it's enough for me. I don't need to go on for a year, you know. And so then I was offered a wonderful BBC television series about the suffragettes and where I played Christabel Pankhurst. So I went off to do 9 months of BBC television after that with Verity Lambert, the producer who was the creator of Doctor Who, and with the director, Waris Hussein, who directed the first Doctor Who.
You mentioned just a minute ago how Mouth really helped to spread the popularity initially of Rocky Horror. Do you feel like that has kind of changed in the way that theater and productions are produced and become popular today?
No, the thing, we were a phenomenon. Like, it doesn't happen. What happened to us doesn't usually happen anyway. So it's nothing to do. There's nothing comparable to what happened to us.
Yeah.
I don't know of anything. Do you?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe like Hamilton in New York City a while back.
Yeah, but Hamilton wasn't a small show, was it?
It started out kind of small, I believe, and then it exploded and they started expanding out.
Yeah, I don't know the history of it.
Well, I have just a couple more questions for you before we wrap up.
Yeah.
And these ones are a lot more just kind of for fun. So definitely feel free to have fun with them. But because this interview is around Halloween time and Robert is such kind of a cult Halloween classic now, a great way for a lot of people to get into the fall.
It's been for ages.
Yeah.
Yeah. Halloween's Rocky Horror time. Yeah.
Do you have any favorite Halloween traditions?
Well, I am a Belfast girl from Northern Ireland. I mean, Halloween is witches and warlocks and very serious, really. I mean, we used to carve out, you have pumpkins, but we had turnips. We'd make the face in the turnip and put things, and then ducking for apples and all of that. And then we used to go around doors. And today, Americans turned Halloween into trick or treat. But how that began was people like me, children like me in Belfast. What we did, we would knock on, because Halloween being before Christmas, we would knock on doors and people would answer the door. And the rhyme was, Halloween's coming on and the goose is getting fat. Would you please put a penny in the old man's hat? If you haven't got a penny, a halfpenny will do. If you haven't got a halfpenny, God bless you. We were collecting money for the turkey for Christmas. That's what we were doing at Halloween.
Wow, that's so interesting. Thank you.
And so then America took it on. It was the biggest thing, Halloween. And then got this thing, trick or treat. But it didn't, that's not what it was about. It began with a serious thing of needing the money. Not really, not every family, but that was the thing behind it. You know what I mean? That was the begging verse.
Wow, that's very fascinating. It's not something that I knew about.
Yes, and it is, you know, it is based in the whole witchery of things, and it's a total witchcraft time.
The witchcraft still, that's a big thing here too. As our time is wrapping up here pretty quickly, I just wanted to once again say thank you so much. If you are interested in catching Patricia Quinn in person, she will be coming to the United States, including Seattle, where there is a big celebration of the, yes, 48th anniversary of the film Rocky Horror Picture.
There's a meet and greet and there's a signing and there's going to be a shadow cast and the show. And I actually just done one of these in New York and I was amazed because I arrived at this very beautiful theater in Patchogue, and in my dressing room, there was a picture of Charlie Chaplin on the wall, a picture of Clara Bow. They'd all played the Patchogue Theater. And I thought, how glorious this place is. It was beautiful, the theater. So then we did signings and photos and meet and greets in the wings of the theater. And then I went on stage and one of the shadow cast did an interview. It was completely sold out. So it was a glorious evening. It was brilliant. So that's what I'm going to be doing in 12 states. I'm doing like almost two a week, it seems.
Wow, that will be very busy for you, I'm sure.
It's glorious.
definitely check that out, especially for any Rocky Horror fans that are listening in. It'll be a great opportunity to do a meet and greet and just kind of celebrate this cult classic, this iconic Halloween film. And again, thank you. Thank you so much, Patricia, for coming on our show.
Thank you so much. Bless your heart.
Well, thank you.
Lots of love.
Benny, did you enjoy listening to that interview just now?
Oh my gosh, it was like music to my ears.
What a great guest we had. Listen to it over and over and over again, and definitely everything I promoted at the end of that interview, check it out. Follow every guest we have on social media because they're all amazing people. Speaking of amazing people, one of our amazing writers at the SGN had the chance to actually be in the press box when the Vice President of the United States of America, the first ever female Vice President of the United States of America, came to Seattle. And that writer is sitting on Zoom with me right now. Benny, please tell me about your experience of breathing the same air as Kamala Harris.
It was interesting. So that was the first time that I've ever gone to one of these press events for a very important political figure. So it's all a part of a tour that the vice president has been on about the Inflation Reduction Act and Bidenomics. It was really interesting. They told us to be there at 9. I was there at 8:30 to make sure that I had a parking spot, get inside at 9. And they all just kind of like corralled us into this one room where we had to wait for, I think, until like 10:30. And that's when we went through security, which Secret Service security, it's not as intimidating as I thought it would be. I thought it would be like a lot. I mean, yeah. Going through Canadian Border Patrol is more intimidating than what I went through. It's very, very much like going through an airport. But that's probably because they probably checked me out before I came. And then we get all, again, corralled into this gym that's been split in half by like a stage and with curtains behind it. And it is hot as balls. It is cramped with all these people in suits.
Well, this was like the heat wave, right? Yes. Were there like when it was like 90 degrees out?
Yes. It was like the hottest day. And I quickly find out that at these kind of events, depending on the AC system, the Secret Service will turn it off for security reasons to make sure that, I don't know, Kamala Harris doesn't get gassed along with the rest of us.
So they won't pat you down, but they will disable the entire AC unit.
They didn't pat us down, but they did do a metal detector wand thingy. I know that the security guy who did the wand and also checked my purse took one look at me, and he just immediately had this face like, oh, this is not a threat whatsoever. I could
literally... But you look so threatening.
I know.
Time.
But, you know, you look at me and it's very clear that you could kill me with one punch. Just immediately out. So go in and we're waiting in this hot, hot room where we're all packed in. At one point, I tried to wade through the crowd to get to near the front to get like as close to Kamala as I could. But then it just was so hot and so packed. I was like, fuck this. So then I waded back through the crowd to get behind the photography like stage where they had like a little stage for the photographers to take their photos and videos, where it was several degrees cooler, but not as much as one would hope. It was great to see that our photographer, Nate Gowdy, he's wonderful.
Love Nate.
Yeah, he was taking photos on his designated spot saying Seattle Gay News. And we were right behind Associated Press and Spokesman Review. That was really cool to see that Seattle Gay News was right with all the bigger fish. We waited for so long. It got to a point where we had our first speakers, right? And the minute the speakers would stop speaking, and it was clear that there wasn't another person ready for like however so long, I figured out a strategy of quickly moving to these other rooms. Just this random empty office that nobody's using, just these random people's workplaces. And I would just sit at somebody's desk trying to cool off between the speakers. But eventually, after the Seattle mayor, Governor Inslee, a couple other people, finally Kamala came up and gave her speech about climate change, what's being done right now with the Inflation Reduction Act that will hopefully, you know, help stop climate change, what we're doing for clean energy production, clean energy jobs. And it sounded pretty cool. It's there are a lot of now tax incentives that are stackable for businesses, which, you know, isn't too interesting. But if you're a business owner, hey, guess what? If you go into clean energy, if you use American-made components, if you hire American workers and apprentices and pay them fair wages and have like a union, you get these stackable tax incentives. So get on that because we need that.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely one of the most important quotes that she said is that the climate clock isn't ticking, it's banging. So we are running out of time.
Yeah.
We need to get this stuff through. And then I remember another speaker said that other countries are seeing our passivity with green energy as their opportunity to get up higher on the world stage. So we gotta get in there.
I love that. I love that she talked about climate change. I went and saw, I covered when Biden was here for the SGN, and he was here on Earth Day and didn't say anything about climate change.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So,
Joe, how could you?
I know. But Kamala was here during the wildfires. So I'm glad that that's something that they're talking about more. And it's so important. Yes, the clock is banging and I don't want to burn with this planet. So,
yeah, I wish I had been I had the chance to be in a part of like the editorial pool, because I was talking with my friends about like, if I had the opportunity to ask a question, what would I ask? And we finally came upon the decision that if I could ask Biden or Harris like a question or something like that, I'd be like, why the fuck don't we have trains? We need an
yes!
a national train system. Get rid of all the planes and the private jets. Let's start the trains.
Exactly. Bullet trains. Like, they're talking about trying to compete with China. We can't compete with China or Japan or any of these countries that have bullet trains.
This is bullshit. Why can't I take a train from Washington to New York? It's ridiculous. We need trains. So, Biden, Harris, I know you're listening.
At least the FBI is, because they'll have to research you.
Play telephone with all the other agents until it eventually gets to the president and let him know that he will become the coolest president that has ever lived if he gives us access to trains to just go anywhere for super cheap.
Yeah, well, please. And think about it like this, okay? He needs voter demographics. You want the young voters. You want the neurodivergent voters. Trains.
Trains.
Yes.
Holy shit. Yeah, he would win all the neurodivergent
exactly.
votes.
Yes.
This is what every American can agree that they want is trains. Because
exactly.
Who doesn't love them?
Honestly, I can't think of anybody. Maybe those old-timey girls that got like tied to the tracks in those black
that
and white
would
movies.
Suck. But then he would get the vote of all the mustache men with the giant top hats who twirl them and talk about their evil plans and how nobody's going to stop them.
Yes, I see no downsides. So, speaking of trains, school is back in session.
I like your train of thought.
Thank you. Oh, that's good. That is so good. This podcast is like a train. If it's the train in Disneyland, that's all crazy. That's my favorite ride at Disneyland, by the way. I like the crazy train ride.
This podcast is like a train. It's gonna drive you locomotion.
Trains. Okay, but I guess speaking of nothing, back to school.
Yeah, let's get back on track.
Benny, you are on fire. God. Like the planet, if we don't invest in trains.
Exactly, exactly.
So we have a trainload of books for children of all ages recommended by the SGN's book expert, a.k.a. me, because I've given myself that title since I've interviewed like over 100 authors now. So I just kind of made a quick little cute list for children of all ages. So if you are a person that has children or has children in your lives, if somebody you know is trying for a child, these are all great opportunities for books, for gifts to give them, especially back to school, because I don't know, I get so nostalgic about back to school time. I loved back to school time as a kid, and mostly it was because I loved reading, and back to school means new books. So just real quick, walk you through the list. For anybody preschool age and younger, we've got some great board books, including Daddy, Papa, and Me, Mommy, Mama, and Me, and Love Makes a Family. So these books are pretty easy to understand. Kids can chew on them because they're board books. It's just the concept of kids with same gender parents. So it's a great introduction, either if your kid has, you know, two mommies, two daddies, or, you know, if you know a family that kid is going to interact with. It's just a great way to, like, normalize the idea of queerness. You're never too young to learn about queerness. Speaking of never too young to learn about queerness, there are some other great early elementary school picture books that I picked out for your children to read. One of them is called Prince and Knight. It's a classic fairy tale, except the prince falls for the knight, not the princess, which is super cute. And it's just great for anybody that, you know, loves fairy tales. But it gives it a little queer twist. And I'm waiting for Disney to make that into a movie. We've also got Love, Violet, which is a book about bravery, about a little girl telling her crush, who's another little girl, how she feels. Yeah, there's so many cute little heterosexual books like that. So why not give us a gay one? And, you know, again, like, just normalize that you can have little crushes on your friends that are the same gender, because parents are always pushing the other way around on their kids.
It will help with a lot of confusion.
Yes. It definitely will.
A lot. Yeah. It's just like, you know, if you have a kid, they're just going to end up asking themselves, gosh, like, I know that I'm supposed to like these other people, but really, I just really, really like my friends. We're just best friends. There's nothing deeper than this.
Yeah. Yeah. If your kid is having weddings on the playground with other little girls, read her this book. At my parents.
Or in my case, right? If your little kid is sitting on the bus with their best friend and they start taking turns giving each other kisses on the cheek, instead of when one of the other kids goes, ew, you guys love each other, instead of your kid, which was me, responding with, yeah, of course we love each other. We're friends. Instead, if they understood that, they could be like, oh, maybe there's something here.
Yeah.
Maybe this isn't the usual activities of friends.
The same idea that you're never too young to be introduced to ideas of same-sex love, because you're not too young to have these concepts. As long as we're having, you know, fairy tale stories, why not have gay fairy tale stories too? You're also not too young to learn about gender, because children have gender forced on them from before they are born with those fucking gender reveal parties that cause wildfires and everything. We've got some great options too. This one book is called Neither. It's super cute. It's like a make-believe book about a land where everybody is either a bird or a bunny, and then this one creature is a bird and a bunny, so it's neither. And it just kind of really breaks down the concept of, like, non-binary, or just the idea of, well, maybe I'm not a girl and maybe I'm not a boy, and maybe that's okay.
That's cute.
It is really cute, and it never mentions gender is the thing too in this book. The whole concept is about bunnies and birds, but I think your kid can apply those standards, and it doesn't even need to apply to gender necessarily. You know, it could be all kinds of things. Expression doesn't need to be binary. And that's also the sentimentality behind the story by Scott Stewart, My Shadow is Purple, which is a really cute story about a kid who lives in a world where boys have blue shadows and girls have pink shadows and they have a purple shadow. And again, you know, what does that mean if I express myself in ways that are both or neither? Male or female. And again, it's just a really good way to first introduce concepts and conversations to your children that they are definitely going to have in their life. You know, and that's the thing, is the day we're at today, it's 2024 and these conversations are happening among adults. The conversations are going to continue to happen. So might as well prepare your kid for it. And then we've also got great books about understanding. So maybe your kid is very comfortable in their assigned gender, the gender they were assigned at birth. But that doesn't mean that the friends in their classes and their siblings are going to be the same way. So these books help create empathy. One of these stories is called Jack, Not Jackie, which is about a little girl whose younger sibling is transitioning. And it helps build empathy for when, you know, somebody in your life is maybe not who you pictured they were in your brain. Another great one is Julian is a Mermaid. Again, it's just a beautiful story about a little boy who wants to be a mermaid. It features a lot of cool drag queen characters and, you know, goes to show that also if you want to transgress gender stereotypes, that doesn't necessarily mean you're transgressing your gender. You know, you can be a boy, be assigned boy at birth, and still want to be a mermaid. Mermaids don't have to just be girls. So we've got so many great books for kids.
The same thing goes for cis people. I mean, you kings out there, you cis kings, you can wear a crop top. You can paint your fingernails black. Like, go for it.
Absolutely. Yes. Gender and gender expression are two different things. And if you're somebody that's struggling with those ideas too, check out these books. These books are not just for kids. You know, like, yes, they are for kids and they're easy to understand, but there's something there. Heal your inner child, reparent your inner child by reading children's books. It's something I do all the time. And, you know, if you're somebody that has maybe a little older child, middle schooler, or like, you know, fifth, sixth grader, there's some great chapter books out there too. One of these books is Melissa. It is wonderful. It's about a transgender child. It's really simple and easy to read. I read it. It's super cute. You can get it from any Seattle Public Library without even needing a library card because it's that important of a book that they want anybody to be able to access it whenever they want. Another great book is Witchlings by Clarabelle Ortega, who I interviewed last year in our fall book club. It's just a fun fantasy novel about queer middle school witches. And then we've got some other good middle school books. Middle School's a Drag, You Better Work, a book about a middle school drag queen, which, oh my gosh, is amazing. I want to live in a world where there are middle school drag queens just out and about because that was not my middle school, but it would have been so fun. Another great one is Almost Flying by Jake Maya Arlo, who was featured just last week in our book club for their latest book, The Year My Life Went Down the Toilet. So check both of those out. They're great middle grade novels about the experiences of being in middle school and kind of discovering your sexuality. Of course, there are some great high school books too. I don't know, Benny, if you've had a chance to read Fun Home. It's by Alison Bechdel. The Bechdel test is because of her.
Oh,
yes. She's amazing. She wrote these comics called Dykes to Watch Out For in the 90s. She's very iconic. And this is her memoir. It's a classic. It's a graphic novel memoir of her childhood growing up queer with her dad, who was closeted and queer as well, reflecting on their kind of shared identities. And this book was made into a Broadway play. It's something that if you don't read in high school and you take gender studies in college, you'll probably read. So definitely check that out, high schoolers. Also, The Lesbiana's Guide to Catholic School is a great, fun Catholic school back-to-school book. And finally, just an all-time favorite of mine is Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe. Benjamin Senez, the author of this book, was featured on this podcast not that long ago. He is just the sweetest person, and this is such a loving book. So for anybody that really just needs that support, check it out. And you wanted to talk about genderqueer as well, because we've both read this book, and it's also on the list.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I really, really enjoyed it. It really affirmed some of my own experiences. I mean, the author's experiences are their own, and not all of them applies to me, but quite a few things I was just like, oh, that's really cool to know that somebody else has felt this way. It's just it's a fantastic way to really get somebody's point of view on their self-expression, on their identity, and their sexuality. And yeah, it was a fun read. I also love graphic novels, so.
Yes, I had to throw in some graphic novels because they're so fun. Also, the art in genderqueer is amazing. Matt Kubabe is a great artist, so check it out for that alone. And also, it goes without saying, none of these books should be banned. Almost, if not all of them, have been banned or challenged in schools across the country. So if you really want to piss Ron DeSantis off, grab some of these books for back to school. Feel free to donate them to teachers or libraries because they're always in need of more books. And at least in Seattle, you're not going to get in trouble for reading any of these. But check them out. They're super fun.
It's crazy that they're trying to ban these books when I, in elementary school, read Ender's Game.
Yeah, you ever read Flowers in the Attic? It's like,
In my elementary school, they had Ender's Game. And I don't know if you've read it. It's a good book. It has some very dark graphic points. And I was like, years later, I was questioning, like, why was that in my elementary school library? And why was I allowed to take it? But, you know, if you're gonna ban one thing, at least be consistent in your belief and try to claim that you also want to ban everything.
Yeah. Oh, let's just not ban books because that's a slippery slope into fascism.
Of course.
I wasn't disagreeing with you either.
Yeah. No, I just want people to be consistent, but of course they won't ever be because it's not about the children. It's about the gays.
Yeah. So if you want to make this back to school year about the gays and about the children and about the gay children, definitely check out those books. The ones I listed, I talked about books for fucking ever, and I'm sorry. But that's definitely not all the books in the list either. There are so many more to check out.
There was a lot.
Yes, there was. Any other book recommendations you'd like to give, please check out Lindsay's Book Corner at the SGN. You can check it out on Instagram as well under the same @. And I post all the books reviews that we do there. So
nice.
That's it. I think it's our podcast. It's back to school season. Oh,
puppy party.
Oh my gosh. Real quick. Sorry, this is going a little longer, listeners, but you must know Benji, my puppy, whose name is very similar to my co-host. He turned one this weekend and we threw an all out puppy party rager. All of his sisters and his mom came to the puppy party. So we got a puppy reunion. Shout out to Blessing, formerly known as Kevin, who I haven't seen since she was adopted. Let's see who else was there. Beatrice, his mother, was there. Faye, we love Faye. She was the teeniest, tiniest puppy, and she's still so small. She's only 7 pounds. Benji's 20 pounds for comparison. I don't know how they came out of the same mother. Yes. And they partied. We did puppy art. We put paint on a canvas and then put it in a bag and put peanut butter on the bag and let the puppies lick it. Aww. And so my puppy made that painting. Yes, they had so many treats. We ordered a dog cake from the Seattle Barkery that was bacon and peanut butter flavored cake. And they were so into that. But really, they just had so much fun getting to see each other again. It was such a good little family reunion. And Benji was exhausted when we came home, which is what you want when you have a one-year-old puppy that is crazy still.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. That sounds so awesome.
Yeah, it was so much fun. And I was like, it warmed my little heart because I fostered all of these puppies for between 8 and like 14 weeks. I had them for so long from the time they were born. Like I got them 3 days after they were born until they were weeks old. And so it was emotional for me to like, you know, send them all on their way. And I got to see them. They came back to me and that was really sweet. So
that is sweet. That's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And those puppy paintings, I kind of want one.
Yes. Oh my gosh, you've got to try it with your dogs. Anybody listening, try the dog painting. It's so fun. It distracts them. It's a great like enrichment activity. And then you get a cute little artwork to put on your wall when you're done.
Cute. I might do that with like a few of my dogs, but I know that my puppies would probably try to crunch through the bag.
Yeah, you might want to double bag it if that's the case.
Yeah, I might have to. All right, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Yes, thank you so much. Please celebrate with your dogs. Give them an extra special like pet and kiss and treat for Benji because it's his birthday.
And read them gay books.
Yeah. So thank you so much. Have a great week. Be kind to yourselves.
Radio SGN is hosted by Benny Loy and Lindsay Anderson and edited by Daniel Lindsley. The music for the show is provided by TRG Banks and Jesse Spillane or was provided for free by Anchor. Thank you so much for listening. Check us out on sgn.org. This podcast is part of the Seattle Gay News Podcasting Network.